Accession number 27748, Reel 7.
Richard Tsonga, Reel 7. I just want to get to the business. You draft the letter. Do you show it to anyone else?
I showed it to him.
And very briefly, what did the letter say?
Well, it said all the things we'd just been discussing. But then, of course, because it was addressed to the captain, it went through the chain of command. So it went to the commander, to my squadron commander first. Well, he dropped it like a hot potato and put it straight to the commander air. And the commander air asked me to go and see him, and he was very nice about it. And he wondered if I was a homosexual or not, and I explained to him I wasn't a homosexual, and that was the only question he asked me about it. Then it went on to the captain, and the captain said, he'd be sorry to lose me, etc., etc., as he didn't lose me, because, the letter then went to the Admiralty and nothing happened.
And did you tell your comrades at arms that you'd written this letter?
I probably did, yes. But, we were too busy getting on with our lives, getting on with the ship's program. It was very busy because we were showing the flag all over the world. And, we were flying off and doing exercises.
So you submitted the letter in the Mediterranean.
Yeah.
Nothing happened. The crisis disappeared overnight.
Yeah. And then we were well through the Suez Canal and didn't seem to be any wars happening anywhere else. And so I sort of it was in the background, but I forgot about it. I didn't then think, is it going to be tomorrow they'll read it or whatever. It was just, I'd done it. I'd done all I could. I just told them I didn't want to go on doing this, and it was up to them then.
But you went on flying.
Yes. And so I had to be, also I felt that I had to be more than keen, because I didn't want to go out with a whimper. I wanted to go out with a bang, so I was going to be as good as I could be. So, I carried on being a vital part of the squadron, or as vital as I could be, yeah.
So, where did the ship go after that? You went through the Mediterranean?
Yeah, and then we went to Aden, and can you pause a minute?
Sure.
We left Malta.
So you've come out of the canal, and you're going down now, you stop at Aden. And what are you as a flyer? You're doing sorties every day, or?
Yes, we're doing, well, not every day. The Red Sea is notorious for calms. And so the other aeroplanes, 809, which were the Sea Venom, they had a much higher landing and takeoff speed or wind speed over the deck. And so we couldn't operate. So we had to wait until we got into more windy conditions. In fact, somewhere in this trip, we did lose one aircraft. It was shot off the catapult and immediately stalled, turned right, and disappeared into the sea. And nobody was recovered from that.
And it was a Venom or a?
Yes, it was. Yeah,
so it was two people.
He was the son of Colonel Khan, of the Glorious Gloucesters, who got, DMBMQ. But he was Rodney Khan, and his observer was Derek Douglas. So we lost them. And then much more restrictions were put on the ship. The wind speed over the deck had to be another 10 knots higher before.
That was thought to be the cause.
Well, it was the cause. It just, it was slack, really, that the parameters hadn't been set tight enough. And so the Admiralty were, they tightened that up a bit. And it was their fault. They shouldn't have shot him off in those conditions.
What was it like flying in the tropics? This must have been, were there different procedures you had to follow?
Yes. Well, not different, but it was very hot. I remember we had these immersion suits for flying over the sea, when they came out, you know, the CO turned up wearing his immersion suit, you know, like a deep sea diver, and said, you know, from now, and we all put ours on for that one day, but it was just impossible. And so nobody said anything, but then we flew with tropical flying suits from then on, which were like an air tech thing. Even so, you come back when you got out of the, you know, everybody's back with black, you know, with perspiration. And you just go down to the shower and shower with it on. And then take it off and continue your shower and then hang it up to dry, you know, so that, in fact, it was better if it didn't completely dry, because when you put it back on again the next day, you know, the evaporation cooled you for a while. You know, it was very hot. And the aircraft did have what was called a sort of air conditioning, but it was very rudimentary. I mean, sometimes, you know, get little bits of ice coming out of the system, which was wonderful and cool air. But after 3 or 4 days, it never did that anymore. So you'd write it in the tech log and they'd change it. And it wasn't up to it. That's what it boiled down to. The temperatures got so high that nothing could, well, not that design of air conditioning could cope.
Yeah. And did the planes handle differently in sort of turbulent?
No, it was okay. We didn't, no, there wasn't a lot of turbulence out there. We did have some very heavy seas. And there are pictures in there of, in the Indian Ocean, where, because all the aircraft couldn't go down in the hangar, you know, there's not enough room in the hangar, they had to be struck on deck. And there's pictures of sea breaking over the aeroplane. Now, the flight deck was, what, 60 or 100 feet above the sea level, and she'd pitch down into it and throw the sea up over the spray up over. And you can imagine the poor old maintenance people having an aeroplane that's been sprayed with salt water, you know. It added a lot to their work, you know, because everything seized up that could seize up, and all the grease on places would be washed away, and so, you know, gave them an awful lot of work. And when we flew, there was a limit of pitch to which you couldn't fly. And that was really when the pitch of the ship itself would enter that 3-degree glide slope that we've been talking about in the sky. So you can imagine the stern coming up and entering that. But up until that point, it was quite unnerving, because as you were coming into land, you mustn't follow the deck. You've got to follow the meatball. But, you know, you'd see that huge deck coming out towards to meet you. You know, you could understand people who would then pull back on the stick a little bit. But again, of course, they would miss the wires. You know, you just had to fly it down and not take any notice of the external factors.
Well, you're getting pretty good at this. It didn't...
Yeah, we got good at it. Yeah, so, you know, by then we were pretty good at it, yeah.
I remember you saying you had an accident with a wire.
Oh, yes, that was, no, they couldn't work out what that was, whether it was, you know, again, signals were sent to the Admiralty, because I came in for a normal landing, the aircraft decelerated, you know, and obviously got a wire, and then there was no more deceleration, and so I pushed the throttle forward, and it trundled along to the edge of the deck and then fell off, and... Well, it wasn't quite that. It probably fell off at about 60 knots, I suppose. And the drop in height, you know, accelerated the aircraft a bit. And because the engine was going, because I'd opened the throttle as fast as it would. And they said afterwards, you know, there was a mark along the sea from the jet pipe, because I was that close. And it seemed to me that the waves were actually coming in front of me. But it gradually, the speed would... You know, slowly, and then it climbed away. And what had happened was that the hook, instead of going round the wire, had got in the lay. Nobody could work out why. And so it was only round one strand of a multi-strand wire, and that couldn't take the strain, and it broke. And there's a picture in there of it. And then they, you know, they cut that piece out, and it was air freighted back to the UK, And the hook was taken off the aeroplane, and that was flown back to the UK. Because they get quite sharp. They've got hardened steel on them, because they're forever hitting a deck and then going running along at 100 and something miles an hour. But we never did find what was wrong, why it did it, because it never happened before. Why it should happen to me, I don't know, just lucky, I suppose.
So now the ship's going around the world, and what do you remember of that cruise? Are there any vivid moments? You went to Ceylon, you went to Aden.
Yes, we went to Ceylon. Everywhere we went, we flew this big A, this big formation, A for Albion. So it was led by the sea venoms. No, one seahawk at the front, and then various combinations of us and the others, and then two of us fitted in to make the crossbar of the A. And we did that everywhere we went. It was a sort of show the flag thing. And then we would take people from those countries, from India, Pakistan, things like that. We would, dignitaries and military attaches and people, they'd go to sea with us for a day while we showed off. You know, we'd do deck landings, we'd shoot at our targets, the gunners would fire their guns, all this sort of nonsense went on. So a typical show the flag cruise around the world, yeah.
And all the time this letter is hanging over you like a sort of delicacy.
No, it's not. Forgotten all about it. Well, not forgotten about it. I knew I'd sent it, but it wasn't the sword of Damocles. I was enjoying life. I didn't even think what I'd do if they accepted my resignation. I had no plan. No, it wasn't hanging over me, no. No, we went then to Japan. Did we go to Japan? I think we did. Certainly went to Australia and New Zealand and Tasmania. Tasmania was a lovely place. So we had lots of swimming, and we met up with American carriers and cross-operated, because their carriers were twice the size of ours. So when you landed, you seemed to be surrounded by acres of deck. You know, our planes looked so small on their carriers, because they had twin-engine bombers and things that came to us, and their wings seemed to hang over either side of our carrier. When we went to theirs, it was completely different. But they were dry, you know, and they didn't have, you know, they did cafeteria messing, you know, where you stood in line with a tray, and it was probably more egalitarian. But because we were being conservative, we liked our old clubby mess, you know, with its armchairs and all the rest of it. And they weren't. They thought it was amazing that we could have drinks. You know, the first thing they wanted when they came on board us was to have a drink. You know, because that was so exciting for them. You know, if they'd been at sea for a month or something, they had done their drink. But I bet they had drink in their cabins. I can't believe they didn't get around that sometime. Yeah.
And what were their reputation as flyers? How were the Americans? Was there any?
Oh yes, they were all Top Gun. You know what the Americans like. You know, they. I'm sure they were good, yeah.
And did you get a chance to go up in any of their planes?
No, we were cross-operating in our own. And we had lots of exercises with fleets, you know, with maybe three or four carriers, lots of Royal Fleet Auxiliaries, because all the time we had to meet a fleet auxiliary somewhere, Indian Ocean, wherever it was, to get more fuel, get food, get mail, all these things. So all the time we were steaming around doing this, there were merchant ships coming out from England or somewhere with aviation fuel oil for the engines. And so we did these refueling at sea things. You know, we steam alongside each other and fuel pipes are passed over and that sort of thing. Yeah, so on one occasion we were transferring avgas on a carrier when avgas, you know, it's so volatile. No fat, you know, the ship gets indescribably hot. You can't have fans running because of sparks and the motors and all the rest of it. So
avgas is paraffin?
Aviation gasoline.
Ah, which is not paraffin.
No, it's petrol, because we had on board Sky Raiders, which were piston engine aeroplanes, so they had to have avgas. And on the stern of this tanker, there was one chap smoking a pipe, and the other guy looked up a fag. And of course, you know, everybody in our ship went ape. I mean, you know, and they were on a tanker, these guys, and so our bridge, you know, contact them, and they, what's going on? And a little figure ran from their bridge all the way back down the chaps put their pipes out. That just shows you familiarity breeding contempt.
Yeah.
So we did a lot of those sort of exercises.
And you didn't get bored. It was busy.
No, you were busy, all the time. It was always, and you entered harbour a lot, and ceremonially, with a band, and you had the aircraft all lined up properly on the flight deck, to make a show, and unless you could get out of it, you'd be detailed to go and stand on the flight deck with your division, to all look smart. And a couple of times, I remember we did this pinwheel thing where you turn the ship by putting the line the aircraft up with the jets pointing over the side and another lot on the stern pointing over the side that way, and then you start up and then you're given a signal and then it pushes the ship round, because they didn't have thrust bow and stern thrusters in those days, it was tugs and all this sort of stuff. So if you could actually maneuver your ship with your own, what a crazy idea, but we did it.
And the British communities ashore, you met?
Oh yes, we met lots of them, and communities wherever, especially in Australia and New Zealand, they were very welcoming. Because I think in those days they felt they were very connected to Britain, but a long way away. They felt a long way away. They didn't feel completely independent, I don't think, and so they liked that link, and they were very generous to us. They took people ashore on bus trips and train trips. We went home. An old Spitfire pilot, I remember, picked me up in Hobart, and I spent the weekend with him and his family, and sailing with a little boat out in the harbour. It was lovely. And, we could talk about aeroplanes and all that sort of nonsense. Yes, it was good. And the RSL, the Returned Servicemen's League in Australia, is very big, and they would take, hundreds of sailors, get them completely jugged up, bring them back and throw them on the quay at the bottom of the ladder, Yes, no, they were very friendly people.
Did you fly any other aircraft during this time? No,
we were always on our Seahawk. We had our own, it was all part of, esprit de corps. So you had your name and the cockpit, and then the air craftsman who looked after your airplane, his name was underneath as well. So, that was his plane. And before entering harbour, a lot of the time we polished the planes. So it was reckoned to be a good thing if you went up and helped them polish your plane.
A whole plane.
Crikey, it was a lot of, we didn't turn up right at the beginning. And, it was just polished. It was like a car, it was pink. And you polish the damn thing. And they did come up looking like new.
Did you do any exercises with other air forces apart from the Americans, the Australians and the Kiwis? Did you?
No, that was it.
For the Indians, you didn't?
Oh, yes, we did. Yes, we had Indian Navy. Yes, we did have exercise with the Indian Navy. Yeah. I think theirs was more, I don't think their carrier came out. I think it was more with their other ships. It was like a convoy exercise, they were attacking a convoy and we were defending it and vice versa.
Yes. And did you land in Bombay or Madras or anywhere like that?
No, we didn't land anywhere ashore. No, it was always on the ship. No, we landed ashore in Singapore. I can remember there, my undercarriage wouldn't come down. The nose wheel wouldn't come down, and so the fireman put a strip of foam all the way down the centre line of the runway, and I went off for, seemed like hours, burning the fuel down, so there was virtually no fuel. And then I got loads of advice on the radio about this, that and the other, and so I came round very slow, because, with no fuel, things, probably flew at 50 knots, I don't know. And then you put it down and you held the nose off to the last minute and then gently lowered it down onto this foam. And they worked a treat. They didn't even have to change the cover, because when the nose was up, there's a cover over it. Yeah, so that was my excitement. And there was another excitement there. The RAF had Sunderlands in Singapore, and they were the last of them. And they were going to set, there were three of these lovely old flying boats, four engines. And they were sold. They were going to be sold to a Chinese scrap merchant. Poor planes. And before they were actually sold, RCA arranged for all our mechanics to go in these planes, and then they took off, and then we took off, and we had a hell of a job flying slow enough. We had to put the wheels down, the flaps down, the air brakes out, to get slow enough to fly alongside these Sunderlands while our mechanics were, you know, waving out the window, because they'd never seen us. Well, they'd seen us airborne from the ground, but, you know, it was a big thrill. Well, for both of us, you know, we seeing them and them seeing us in the air. And then once they landed, I mean, they were beautiful to watch landing, just like a swan. Yeah, I mean, they were very clumsy swans, but even so, you know, they came lower and lower and lower. And then a little fin of white water would follow them, which was there, just the very stern of the boat hull touching the water, very delicately done. Then that would get bigger and bigger and bigger, you know, and there was huge wash of water being pushed along. And then they took them ashore and cut them up. Yeah, it was tragic, really. They were beautiful aeroplanes, though. So big. You know, walk around inside them. Two decks. Yeah, quite incredible. And there was galleys, and the mechanics were telling us how they made tea for them, you know, and inside the aeroplane. Yeah, quite incredible.
They used to fly across the Pacific, didn't they?
Yeah, they did. Yeah.
From island to island.
Yeah. Yeah.
So now we're coming round to the... So the ship is now heading home. You've been away for how long? About
a year.
A year.
Yes, it was virtually a dead year.
And it was virtually a year since you'd written your letter, and still no sign of that.
Yes, that's right. And so when I came back, I then, you know, what happens next? And I was thinking, oh, I'll probably get a letter saying, thanks very much, but you're no longer required. Instead of that, I got a letter saying I'd been posted to where I was supposed to go in the first place, you know, the whole point of all this, to the maintenance test pilot school at Aberystwyth, up in Paisley, which is now part of Glasgow Airport. But then there were two airports. There was a civil airport and then the naval airport a bit further west. And what they've done is push the hedges and the roads and all that, and made them one. And we, it was interesting, the shipyards were still operating on the other side of the Clyde, you know, big shipyard. And when we did our instrument approaches, which, you know, brought us on a certain runway, they had to line the cranes up in line with the slipway, because, you know, our track was coming down that slipway. God, it's funny to think of those days, isn't it? It's just phone up the shipyard and they'd move the cranes around and we'd land. Yeah.
To give you the right, or just to get them out of the way? Sorry.
To get, yes, it was because if the cranes were, you know, our flight path was sort of virtually in line with the slipway. And so if the cranes were across, if you were a bit low, they could be a hazard. I mean, you'd never be that low. But I mean, you know, if something happened, it would be silly not to. So they moved the jibs around so they were parallel to the slipway. And so we were then able to, we were clear to land then.
So you'd left the squadron now?
Left the squadron, and I was at this maintenance test pilot school where we... It was a very relaxed sort of place. They had several different sorts of aeroplane there.
Can you quickly go through the kind of... I mean, what exactly your job was and what kind of aircraft you...
Well, your job was to learn to be one, but it was also a maintenance base. So once you'd had a couple of fly-arounds the local area, when an aeroplane, say, had been checked off for most things and maybe... the radio wasn't working very well or something, you'd be given that one. So you just have to fly out, go a couple hundred miles away, check the radio, check the navigation beacons, that it all indicated properly, bring it back and sign it off as being serviceable. And that military airplane would then be allocated to a squadron.
And what kind of aircraft were these?
Oh, it was a Seahawk.
So yes. They were always Seahawks?
Yeah, they're all Seahawks, because that was then the Navy fighter, so that was all the production line was for that. At the same time, there was the Sea Vixen and the Scimitar, and they were there to be evaluated and their pilot's notes. Every aeroplane has pilot's notes, which are in the aeroplane and also given to the pilots to read up before they fly the aeroplane. And they were there for these test pilots who were doing those two aeroplanes to write the pilot's notes. But they were the next generation of jet aeroplanes. You know, they were very noisy, very fast, two engines.
And how did, I mean, what about learning the cockpit? You must have had some training, presumably, when you went from a single engine to a double engine jet.
No, no, we didn't fly these.
Oh, you didn't? Right.
No, no, that was the, you know, the posh, the boss of the school was doing that, and his number two. We just got the airplanes that had been newly painted from the factory and went and flew those.
And how was that? I mean, did they?
Oh, it was a lovely job. Oh, yes, because I had some friends over at Crinan on the west coast of Scotland near Scarborough and Jura, and so I always, everybody had their test place, you know, they went and do it, but you didn't want it to be another airfield or an air route or something like that. So I'd go out to the Western Isles, because you had to do high speed runs, you had to do stalls at various levels, all this sort of stuff, and there was a lot of doing things and writing on your knee pad, you know, ticking things, and so you didn't want to have to worry too much about the outside world, you know, you just wanted to get on with doing this routine, so you needed to pick a quiet place, you know, to do it. And so I used to go out there, yeah.
And it was a long checklist that you had to work through, more or less all the systems on the aircraft.
Yes, all the systems on the aircraft, and you had to do all the emergency things on the aircraft, and then there were all the performance things, so, you know, on takeoff you had to set takeoff power. Then you had to set climb power, you had to climb at, you know, maximum rate of climb, note it, how many, you know, stopwatch, how many minutes to 10,000 feet, all this. And then that was all written on the test sheet. And then somebody on the ground would look at that and compare it with a standard aeroplane. And then if it didn't, it was okay to exceed it a little bit, but it mustn't be less than the standard aeroplane. And then you would also write on handling characteristics, you know, left wing low, or you always needed the rudder trim not quite on takeoff for takeoff, and it'd be further, all this sort of thing. And then that would be adjusted, and then it would be ready for its next test flight. So the idea being that you kept knocking off defects until the aircraft was completely serviceable, you know, absolutely spot on, and then it was sent off to do its job.
And how many test flights would you have to do?
Well, sometimes only one. Yeah, you know, really just a test flight. In other words, you were just writing down all the parameters. There was absolutely nothing wrong with it, which is amazing, really, because, I mean, they were virtually brand new. They were actually old aeroplanes refurbished, but everything was new. And they'd just been bolted together very carefully and set up. So, I mean, it's amazing that they had. It says a lot for the technicians that they could do that.
Richard Songer, Real 8. So, you mentioned also that there were other piston engine planes that you had that were on the base. You had a chance to. What were they? Which go through those?
There was a C. Balliol, which was a Spitfire engine side by side aeroplane. And we used to use that. That was their hack. And if there was an altimeter needed for an aeroplane, but there was one available, it was just like working for a motor factor. You know, you just drove off in this thing somewhere else, and you had a nice lunch in the wardroom somewhere else, and then you pick up this spare part that was needed, and then fly it back to Abbots Inch for. Yes, I mean, I enjoyed doing that, because you got a good view of Scotland, you know, because you didn't. All our other stuff required going to altitude when you were testing the Seahawk, but, I mean, this was just a cab driving, so you could fly up the Great Glen or, you know, go on that low route between Glasgow and Edinburgh, you know, and then up to Dun. Yeah, it was good fun flying that.
And what other planes?
I think they had a Sea Fire and a Sea Fury.
Sea Fury was...
That was the radial-engined aeroplane.
How did you find the Sea Fire to fly?
Oh, that was lovely, yeah. They were the nice aeroplane. They were... Well, they were no nicer than... I mean, I'd much rather fly a Seahawk. you know, because it was, it's modern, you know. I mean, there was all the nostalgia stuff, but, you know, there's so many things to do in a piston aeroplane. You know, you've got to watch the cooling and set the flaps accordingly to, or the cooling flaps, so that you cooled the engine at the right rate. You didn't have it too cool, you didn't have it too hot. Whereas your jet engine, it's just going round. You know, you haven't got to do it at all. Also, you've got all that swing on takeoff when you open the throttle.
Through the torque of
the... Yes, the torque. You know, the engine wants to stay still and rotate the airframe around it. Yeah, and you've got to watch the oil pressure and, you know, all those, any one of those things can mean the end of the engine, whereas I don't think I heard of one of our jet engines ever failing. Not ever. Not in my career, anyway. Whereas several times, you know, you had piston engines fail. After my career in the Navy, I had a piston engine stop on me. You know, it was the points, you know, the ignition points, you know, something as basic as that. But they both failed. Each airplanes have two magnetos to prime ignition, and they both failed within about 5 seconds of each other. So that was clever.
Why were there sea fires and furies at this?
Oh, they were just junk.
So they were just for you to
joyride. Yeah, just to practice. Well, yeah, just to give you some